This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is April 17th, the year 2000. I'm at 2820 Marshall Court in the home of Donald McCarty, and we're going to continue the interview, conclude the interview that we began last week. Last week, in our first session, we talked about your relationship with Ed Young and some of the other people who were above you. But the one person we only mentioned in passing was Irv Shane. Could you tell me a little bit about your contact and your relationship with Irv over the years?
Well, I liked him because he was a person who was always well prepared. You knew if you presented data to him that he would study it very carefully. He always carried a lot of work home. I knew that. He was very responsive, and I felt he liked education as a discipline. You know, he was sympathetic to it, which is very important in a discipline like education, which doesn't have some of the other advantages. People often see education as a dismal science.
It doesn't get the respect.
Doesn't get the respect or the medicine. Finances, yeah, right. Which of course can, when you have a big operation like the School of Ed, it's very important. He is not what I would call a gregarious human relations kind of administrator. He goes to you directly, you know. I mean, you feel you better be prepared. You're going to get an answer, and you can go away knowing where you stand. But you don't have a feeling, you know, that he's your warm-hearted friend or anything like that. And I think that may have had some difficulties, you know, with the athletic department and people like that, where he was not perceived as a Donatello, as a cheerleader type. Because he's basically an academician. He's a chemist, and he's a man's man. He goes and oversees to Portugal and dives into the water. He's that kind of a guy. So, I mean, I found him very admirable from that standpoint, because I prefer my administrators to be that way. I mean, straightforward, quick, easy to respond, give you a direct answer, supportive, you know, basically of your operation. You have a feeling that if something went awry, that he would give you a chance to explain. You know, you don't have this feeling that he would double deal in any way, or that. So I found my relationships with him to be splendid from my standpoint.
And he was when Young was chairman, was chancellor. Irv Shane was vice chancellor. Did he have a lot of contact with you and the other deans?
Ed Young?
No, Irv Shane. I'm sorry.
Yes,
when
he
was vice chancellor.
Oh yeah, he had a lot of. See, he was really handling the finance aspect of it. You went to him if you had a problem. You don't go to see Ed Young unless it's a desperate situation. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I see.
And why would you deal with it? You wouldn't have to in the case of Shane, because he's going to handle it.
Yeah.
I mean, if Shane has to check with Ed Young, he's going to do that in his own good time. So I would always go to Shane because I would know I would get a quick response. I could get in quickly and almost on a moment's notice, certainly very little delay. And I would get an answer. That's what I'm looking for. Then I can go blithely on my way. See, so I used him as my contact, you know, in the chancellor's office. He was the chief of as far as I was concerned.
Okay. The majority of our discussion today is going to center around your teaching, research, and service in the Department of Admin after you left the deanship. Let's talk about some of the courses that you taught. Which courses did you teach most often during your years in Edmund?
I taught supervision most often because when I went over there, that was what was available, because I and Netzer were just finishing up, and that was their domain, and nobody else wanted it. So you have to take what's available. Then I
had you had experience teaching that at Cornell?
No, I hadn't.
Oh, so this was a new field, but a new area for you.
Supervision is something that, since these were public school administrators who were teaching, of course they have to do, it's one of their critical. And I got up to speed in a hurry about, you know, the literature and so forth. And then I did some research in that field later, but my main interest was politics of education. I had begun that through my dissertation at Chicago, and then when I went to Cornell, I got a research grant from the U.S. Office of Education, and doing a major study of politics of education. And then I also I was working for President Perkins on leadership, you know, so that was a political sort of thing, you know. Basically, we were learning all these things. And I wrote a book called The School Managers as a result of my U.S. office grant. In fact, I finished it up when I came to Wisconsin. I had all the data collected. And I got an award just last year from the Politics of Education, the Roald F. Campbell Award for Excellence in Research in Politics of Education at AERA, the American Educational Research. It's one of those things up here on the wall. So it takes a long time from the time you do something to the time you get... That book of mine has been cited over and over again. Mm-hmm. It has, I think, a very interesting... some conclusions there, and people picked it up. So that's my greatest claim for fame and research was in the politics of education. So I eventually taught that in the department mm-hmm. when an opportunity came, of course, because that was really my expertise. And then I also taught qualitative research, because that's kind of the research I've always done at the University of Chicago. My dissertation was qualitative, and of course that was the school or the university that began a lot of qualitative research, some of the famous works done by the sociology department. And I taught that, and then I, the other course, I sometimes did organizational theory. I had done that at Cornell. So I was teaching qualitative research, politics, organizational theory. Basically, that's what I taught, mm-hmm. four courses.
Did you ever do any interdisciplinary or collaborative teaching?
Well, my original study was McCarty and Ramsey. Ramsey was a sociology professor at Cornell, mm-hmm. and we were friends. We lived very close to each mm-hmm. other, and I talked to him about some of my concepts out of my doctoral dissertation. He said, let's get a grant for this done, you know, and he worked with this, a joint effort. He was given a job in Minnesota, so we got the giant grant when he was still at Cornell, mm-hmm. but then he went to Minnesota. So he collected data in Minnesota, and I collected data in the East Coast. So it was very collaborative, because mm-hmm. when I came here as dean, we used to meet mm-hmm. halfway up there between Wisconsin and Minnesota to work. So that was interdisciplinary. Of course, my Cornell experience was mostly all interdisciplinary, mm-hmm. and these things we did for Perkins we brought in. I believe in interdisciplinary research, you know, working with other mm-hmm. disciplines. When I came here, of course, I really couldn't do that. I was a dean, you know, so mm-hmm. I mean, that takes all your energy. You can't really be a researcher and be a dean. I mean, a full-time researcher. And when I went back to the department, we had the R&D Center, and at that time, Ross Miller and Fruth and Lipham were working on these interdisciplinary projects. But they never invited me, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, I was the ex-dean coming back, you know, and I couldn't very well participate unless someone asked me.
You're right, you just don't bully your way. I'm the former dean.
You don't bully your way in because, as I said, it takes time, you know, to change the gears and people begin to see you as a colleague instead of as an administrator, because there's always some kind of a tension between leaders and followers. Mm-hmm. They don't see themselves as followers, but you have the powers of certain things that are important to them. And so I don't care how nice you are or well-meaning you are, there's always going to be some stress there. So when you go back, you have to take it easy, I guess. So I never had a chance to get involved in any interdisciplinary stuff when I went back to the department.
I was kind of surprised when I went and worked for the R&D Center for a while that a lot of the articles, Lipham is the one I'll use as an example because I worked with Professor Lipham a lot, that five or six or seven or eight people would sign every article. Yeah. And I noticed that this was common throughout Edmund, and coming from the field I did, that just never occurred. Was that something that has happened all along in that field, or is that something that kind of came into vogue? Or?
Well, I think what they were doing is trying to get very things for the dossier, you know, the, mm-hmm. you know, you get promoted here, you get your mm-hmm. salary increase on publications. So even if you're listed as one of the junior authors or one of the authors, you can put it down as a publication.
Okay.
You're not the major author, you know, the senior author is really the first person.
Yeah, right.
And it becomes a way of, and Lipham was very good at this. He knew how to build a dossier.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he ever did anything on his own, you know, Campbell Gregg and Lipham and things like that. I never cared much for that kind of what I would call false doctoring of your vita.
Mm-hmm.
As most of us know, you're either the major, I mean, as a chur, are you the major person mm-hmm. there, or are you just one of the troops? But that was what they were doing, basically, in my opinion.
Well, I witnessed times where I wondered exactly how much some of these people actually participated in the experience. But
well, the grad students might have done most of the work.
That seemed to be the case.
They were supporting it. They brought in a lot of people from Australia. These were very bright people. They did a lot of the field work. And, of course, then you put the professor's name on the work.
It was just a very different experience for me. I just hadn't been familiar with anything quite like that before. You taught for a number of years, first at Cornell and then here. Tell me a little bit about, if you can, this is kind of a hard question, about your approach to teaching and how it changed over the course of your career.
Well, I think you have to go your back. When I began at Columbia as a student, I went in the history department. I had beautiful lectures, these well-known people like Henry Steele Commager.
Mm-hmm.
It was a pleasure to listen to him.
You had great lectures.
He would just come in before these large groups of 200 people and give these levelless lectures. We would all take our notes. That was the day before tapes, recorders, and all.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I was used to. And as I may have mentioned last time, I went over to Teachers College Club and they started doing group work. And I thought, this person is cheating me out of my salary. My tuition money. So when I came out to teach, after I got my PhD at Chicago, naturally, when I went to Cornell, the first thing I started to do is I thought I should be a good lecturer.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried to develop the style of lectures that I'd been used to at Columbia, basically, well-crafted,
mm-hmm.
Well-prepared lectures with a touch of humor. I'm Irish, mm-hmm. I like to keep people laughing and energized. But then I thought, these are, after all, people who want to become school administrators, so I developed case study. I get some case studies from Harvard because that was the way
mm-hmm.
they... And that's when I began to use case studies. Part of the time, maybe one-fourth of the time, I'd have them work on a case study. And I could see they loved that, the students, because they could participate
mm-hmm.
in it. And they were very bright people. I began to realize, hey, they're teaching each other, and they're teaching me, too. And they seemed to think it's perfectly legitimate. I was getting good my ratings were high.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I got the students involved in various activities, the higher my ratings. So I became more of an advocate of getting the students involved and participating, student-teacher planning sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think we should be doing? And I became a better teacher, I think. But, of course, we are in a type of discipline. It's not like history,
mm-hmm.
where you're not talking about Andrew Jackson.
All these, the causes of the War of 1812.
No, see, it isn't quite like that.
It's not as information fact-oriented.
It's in a sense, you're trying to prepare a person to be a leader. Like Saturday, I was over at Cardinal Stritch giving lectures on leadership, and I'm really talking about it in an integrated kind of a sense. But I'm not doing the same sort of thing I would do if I were a history professor. So, and I think the nature of your subject affects the way you should teach.
Mm-hmm.
And in an applied field like educational administration, I think you have to get students involved talking about things that they have to face and how they would go about doing it and critiquing. That's what you want them to do, is become a rational person who takes a look at problems and tries to do some choices and makes choices based on thinking of various alternatives. In other words, that sort of thing, you have to think about the consequences. See, this becomes more of it's a little different type of thing. It's an applied field. It isn't as dramatic. I would have rather been a history professor. Because in fact, I even knew what my I even had my idea of what my thesis would be on. It was going to be on Father Coughlin, the famous Irish priest, that created so much trouble. He was a Nazi, basically. See?
Mm.
And I thought, well, he's an Irishman. Won't that be fun? I'll be able to write this up and write the definitive study of Father Coughlin, which has never been done.
Interesting.
That required, as I mentioned, I was older than most students because of the war, and so I knew to get a PhD in history would take me forever. I would have gotten a job probably in those days because a history PhD from Columbia with those famous professors, almost invariably, at least I would have gotten to Ripon College or someplace, rather than Slippery Rock State Teachers College, which is, I think teaching applied field, you have to learn these sorts of things, and I think I learned it pretty well, over time to be a better teacher of what I was teaching. But I started out as a lecturer, and then I ended up more as a pragmatist, dealing with its students in practical manners.
Did you enjoy teaching?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I like it. I think part of it is because I'm an actor in my own mind. Mm-hmm. I like playing parts. I mean, I love being on stage. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. a teacher is an actor. You know, you're a performer.
Right.
Even if you're getting other people going, you know, I mean, it's exciting. It's interesting work. Teaching is fun. You're not rewarded for it in a place like Wisconsin. I mean, because the only way you get in trouble here is if you're so bad you get stoned by the mm-hmm. students. You know, you're known as a real terrible teacher, then you might get penalized. But if you're a great teacher, you're not likely to get any rewards. Every now and then you have teaching awards where they give $1,000 to the best teachers. I think that's nonsense, you know, because how do you go about determining it? Well, somebody makes a recommendation for you, maybe somebody in the botany department. I mean, who knows who the best teachers are at Wisconsin? I mean, they give rewards to five people, but they're probably better than average teachers. But I mean, there are probably a lot of other teachers
who might not have the connections or the,
or someone willing to write them up. You know what I mean?
Write.
You know how that is.
Oh, I know.
And because in a sense, if you write something up, you're more apt to this mm-hmm. person's more apt to get mm-hmm. the award.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember Ian Netzer used to be on that. And one year, Glenn I came out as one of the greatest teachers, you know, and I knew very well he wasn't anymore. But I'm as a person who teaches politics, you see, I tend to think about these things from a political standpoint. And I think even the chancellor would probably realize what he's really doing, in my opinion, is trying to indicate teachers important here.
That's right. Yeah.
And we have to have some ceremony that indicates that.
That's right.
And to that, that's okay. It doesn't matter whether these people are really the best teachers or not. They're probably okay.
Yeah.
They're not. But, so this is...
It's a message to parents and teachers and students and to professors that we really care about you.
That's exactly right. And, of course, it probably makes those people feel good to get them, too.
Sure. It looks nice on the resume, too.
I'd be glad to have it.
When you were dean, we talked about this earlier, you got this program that you worked with Hank on about increasing minority or women's pay.
Yeah.
What about ed admin in terms of women and minority in terms of students? Was there any active, what was the situation like, and were there any moves to increase numbers in those areas?
Well, you know, the first thing that happened is we got a lot of women students and all this. As it became apparent that women were going to be able to get certified and become actually school superintendents instead of just being maybe principals or elementary principals.
When did that start about?
It started about the time that I went back there around 75, I think.
Okay.
This was the beginning of the movement.
Mm-hmm.
So we began getting a lot of, at one time you hardly saw any women in education administration, very rarely. Then all of a sudden they got up to 50% because job opportunities, they are now, you see, probably more women, or just as many women as there are men in educational administration. It was because they can get the jobs.
Mm-hmm.
They can become superintendent of schools now, high school principals, elementary principals, supervisors, you know, which would, assistant superintendent for instruction, mm-hmm. things of this nature. So the students came first. We only had one woman professor in the Department of Ed and Men when I was there, and when I went back in 75. There are a few more now, of
mm-hmm.
course. They've added a few. And they've had a little difficulty, I think. Now, we've never had a minority professor in Ed Admin that I know of. Now, we did try to recruit African-Americans when the Office of Education was offering grants. We applied and we got one. For a while, we had some urban school fellowships. We brought people in from Chicago, St. Louis. So for a while, we had some African-American graduate students. But that's kind of petered out now, you know, because we don't have any grants, and so there are very few African Americans that take added men here at Madison, because Milwaukee, of course, is where they are.
Okay.
They don't come to Madison. So
there's a program in Milwaukee for.
Well, there's a added men program in Milwaukee, UW Milwaukee.
Yeah.
Which they can get into, so they're right
gotcha.
There. It's the same kind of program we have here. You can get it at night. In fact, it's modeled after our program. It's almost identical. Most of the professors over there came through Madison in the program. So I would say that we haven't done very well with minorities. An occasional Hispanic, some Asian people, but they're usually from Korea or someplace like that, foreign students.
Mm-hmm.
Not Asian Americans are too smart to get an ed admin. They go into sciences. I mean, you know.
They get the high paying jobs.
The 4.0s, you know, they're not going to mess with admin. So I would say we're still primarily white, evenly based between male and females now, not very many African Americans, not very many anything else. It's basically, that's the way it is.
You mentioned just a few moments ago that there were Australians, and I remember when I worked there, there were several Australians.
Right.
Why? What kind of connection did we have? How did that come about?
Well, Lepham liked to go to Australia, see, and he was smart, and he got a connection there, and then he would go out there and give lectures on organizational theory and pick up these students who wanted to get a PhD, and we had the grants, you see, the office, because of the R&D center, so he'd bring these people in, and they'd stay up at Eagle Heights with their family. Mm-hmm. They get reasonable, they get enough money to survive on, they get a PhD from Madison. And they were Lepham students, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So he brought in his own high quality. These were high quality
people. Oh, these
were
the people
these
I know.
These were top-notch.
Very smart people, yeah.
They were top-notch people. They often held very important positions in Australia. Mm-hmm. This was the capstone of their career. And so they could do things. Mm-hmm. I was impressed with them. I mean, when they would come into class, mm-hmm. they were bright people. Now that died off, of course, when we didn't have the support. We don't have the support systems, because right now the only support systems we have are through money that we get for teaching off campus and things like that.
What happened to the old support system? Did that just...
Well, I mean, the grants, when we have the R&D center, you see, but the admin people are not integrated into the R&D center the way they were.
Yeah.
So when Ross Miller turned that over, basically, that was the end of the admin's inside track to the R&D center.
That's too bad, isn't it?
It is too bad for the R&D center. I told him at the time, I said, you'll never get back in there again. But he'd had enough, I mean, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he'd been running and he was tired.
Ross Miller.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, he wanted to get out. You know, it's like anything else.
Right. Well, there's a lot of responsibility.
I mean,
he'd
had, his salary had gone up, you know, he'd been teaching in Wisconsin all his life. I mean, he's a multimillionaire, you know. Mm-hmm. Ross Miller knows how to invest properly, and he's got a very good retirement. He doesn't even have to pay tax, you know, because he was on it, you know, the state retirement. It's really something, and I think he's had enough, you see. But he did take the chairmanship mm-hmm. because he knows he likes control,
mm-hmm.
like most administrators. He understands control.
Got the budget.
Hated the budget. See, he had the budget so he could take care of himself there, too, mm-hmm. you know. So he wasn't worried about himself, and... I think he just got tired of running that big operation. I mean, so that's what happened.
Mm-hmm. You served as mentor to students, obviously, as a major professor. Every student is special in their own way, but could you just talk about you don't have to go into detail on every one, but talk about a couple of the students that you had that sort of jump out at you.
Well, Jim Rickabaugh is one. He was this person who was working down in Janesville, and he came up. And I liked him right away, and we developed a dissertation on people who select school superintendents. You know, some people make a living by acting as search teams, you know. For,
mm-hmm.
And he wrote a dissertation on that. And when he got through, he got the job of superintendent of school at Oconomowoc, and then he got up to Burnsville, because by knowing all these search people, I mean, he became
mm-hmm.
on everybody's list, because they knew he was a good
mm-hmm.
man. He's now going to the back in Milwaukee. He's going to be right in my back door from Cardinal Stritch. He's going to be superintendent of Whitefish Bay.
Oh, really?
Which
oh,
is called White Folks Bay over there.
White Folks Bay.
So
yeah.
He's because he's coming back, I think, to get his Wisconsin retirement, which is very good to add. But he's also got a first-class job now. Now he was an exceptional person. When I retired, I had him as a student who spoke about me, you know, and he got up there and. Used my mannerisms and everything else. And the styles that you have that you don't realize. And he had the confidence to get away with it. So, of course, I've always liked him. I had Jane Lindell was one of my students. I picked her up from special education up north in some outpost up there. Brought her into Madison. She's a very bright. She got her degree, and she's now down at the University of Kentucky teaching politics of education. She followed my style mm-hmm. of stuff, and in fact, I'm sure she's behind my getting this award because mm-hmm. she became a leading the light in the Politics of Education Association. That's how you get these awards. Somebody nominates you that knows you. She's done very well. I see her all the time at conventions. Johanna Kaufman is one of my favorites. She was my grad student for 2 years when she was getting her PhD, and she really helped me. She's a brilliant woman. She's now the assistant superintendent over here at
Middleton
Cross Plains, and I'm sure she's doing an excellent job. Mm-hmm. She had real talent. And the other one was Pedro Ruiz. He was a Hispanic American. I didn't realize it. When he came to me, he didn't have anything at all in the way of money. It was on one of these grants that, mm-hmm. that he gets from the grad school for minority people. And he got his PhD, and I helped him. He was my grad assistant for a year. And he's now down at the University of Texas.
He's in Austin?
Yeah.
Oh, my.
As a professor, and he's been president of the University Council for Education Administration. Every now and then he's interviewed for deanships, but he's very careful. He's going to get one eventually because, you know, he's a red hot. And he calls me every now and then, and it's good to see someone go ahead, you know, like that. He's a good example of a minority who's made it on his merits.
Mm-hmm.
He's very bright. He always wanted to be a professor, and so I put him in Ed Psych, and I said, what you got to do is learn as much Ed Psych as you can, you know, get all these statistical stuff down fast. And he became an expert. See, that put him a leg up. You know, he's a knowledgeable person. I mean, he doesn't have to give any quarter. And he's got high standards, so he'll do very well. So those are the four that that I remember as being exceptional for different reasons.
You served as a visiting professor on four different occasions.
Yeah.
Could you talk about each one of those briefly?
Well, the first one at the University of New York at Buffalo was...
that was in 62.
When I was at Cornell. And we went up there. We had an inter-university project supported by the Ford Foundation. Buffalo, Syracuse, Rochester, and Cornell. Four universities, inter-university program. And we were teaching. We had interns from each school, six from each school. And I taught in that sequence. That was the reason I was there. I spent summer there teaching this inter-university project. You know, it was a seminar, and we brought in visiting speakers, and we taught ourselves. It was kind of fun. It was very intense.
That sounds very nice, yeah.
But I learned a lot from it. Now, what I like to do, I didn't take my family on that because it was too close. What I like to do is get away in the summertime, give my family a vacation. I have four children. So when I was at Cornell, and the next year I thought, well, I like this. I think I'll go to... I saw an advertisement in the Placement Bureau for somebody to teach summer school at New Mexico Highlands University. So I applied, and they gave me the job, and I went out to New Mexico Highlands.
Where is New Mexico?
Las Vegas. It's Las Vegas, New Mexico. That's the name of the town.
Yeah.
It's a small town. It's really Hispanic. I mean, it's a Hispanic university, and I get in there, I mean, and I've got Indians and Hispanics mainly.
Mm-hmm.
And I did very well because I prepared well, and I enjoy teaching, so I'm working hard. And we were staying in a nice little hotel by the train. We're going by there, and the kids had a good time. And so the president called me and offered me a job in New Mexico Highlands.
Oh, really?
And the reason, I suppose the student said, and the reason is I think they weren't used to that much effort on the part of a teacher. I was... they had a lot of nice people there as teachers. What they would do is they'd go up in the mountains and fish, and, you know, they were more concerned. They would talk about what are we going to do as soon as the week is over. They weren't interested in doing research. I mean, they were living the high life.
Yeah.
They weren't getting big money, but they didn't have to work too hard. Their students weren't all that powerful. I mean, in their own mind, I don't think. So, I think my teaching probably stood out. You know, as something unusual. But of course, I didn't take it, obviously, because I would have been just like them in 5 or 6 years. You know, I mean,
well, of course,
you fall right into
support,
it.
Yeah.
So then, but the kids had a great time. And then the next time when I came here to Wisconsin, Peter Mickelson was here. Saying, so I mentioned my interest in this sort of thing. So he says, why don't you go out to Western State College in Colorado in Gunnison? That's where. He had been. It's over the mountains, you see. It's over the mountains. It's really in the wintertime, it's terrible, you know, 50 degrees below zero. It's a ski resort place. But in the summer, it's beautiful. And I taught there, and there was an artificial lake there, and the kids had a great time fishing, and it was a nice place in the summertime. And we had good quarters. it made a kind of a cheap vacation, is what I'm saying. I didn't get paid much money, $1,000 or $1,200, you know, I mean, minimal amounts of money, but I was taking my vacation here, and I was having a good time and getting enough, you know, to sort of break even. And the last time was I thought, let's go to Maine. So I happened to know the dean at Maine. His son had been my student at Cornell. Mm-hmm. Mark Scheibels, his name was. And so I called up the father, and so I went to Maine, taught one summer there, and we lived. Ed Young, in fact.
Yeah, he was chancellor.
When I found out I was going there, had a friend, and he got me a place to stay right by a lake. It was the lakes are cold in Maine. Mm-hmm. But Ed did me a real favor, because this was a delightful place. It was beautiful.
You had your four kids there at Maine, and you took the dog?
And we had a canoe, you know, and the kids could play around. And I drove from this lake into the campus every day. But they were free to enjoy themselves. And they had a great time, mm-hmm. see. And we went over, tripped around Maine. You know, it's a great place to visit in the summertime. And so this was a break, too. Mm-hmm. And Ed Young came by one day and went swimming in the lake, see. Because he was a Maine
person. Yeah, he was a Maine person.
So, and his picture was there in the University of Maine. And, of course, I enjoyed working there. It was a lot of fun. And so that's what
That's great.
Was what we did.
So these were as much for kind of getaways as anything else.
Yeah. I was just doing it in a way, because I like to teach, you see, and it made it good for the family because we were away from all other things. Mm-hmm. We would be together as a family.
That's right.
We'd eat and play together, and it was a time for me to get to know them better, too, you know.
Nice places, New Mexico.
Nice places. Yeah. Different places.
Yeah. Research. You described four areas of scholarly research, or you list four areas of scholarly research on your CV. Perhaps we could approach the topic of research by looking at each one of these areas. The first one we've talked about, you talked about just a little bit before, the politics of education, especially the superintendency. Is there anything you'd like to add to that?
Well, that was my doctoral dissertation, was why do they do it, motives for seeking school board membership. Mm-hmm. And out of that, I developed this realization that the superintendent's really a political job. Mm-hmm. And then I did research on it, and I wrote a book on it, and which I think became very well known. And so that was my main, that's where my reputation really mm-hmm. came. And as a researcher, I brought that with me. It may have had something to do with my coming here, I don't know.
Well, you said, when we talked about it last week sometime, you said that it was this research that helped you determine, helped convince you that you did not want to become a superintendent because you were so at the beck and call of the school board and whatnot. Did any other people get that out of your work? Did you ever talk about that?
Oh, yes.
Perception?
I developed a 4-foot table. I said, now look, there are four different kinds of communities. There's a factional community, you know, that is where the people are arguing among themselves all the time. There's a desirable, ideal community, the democratic, status, congruent community, where it's really everybody is a good citizen, you know, and it's the ideal, it's just reading the literature. Then there's the community where nothing is going on at all. It's an inert, you can't get any dynamism. And then you've got the dominated community, like Kohler, Wisconsin, or mm-hmm, something,
right,
or the Kohler Corporation.
Factory town.
Yeah, runs the place, basically.
Right.
Now, the thing I pointed out, as you were going to be an administrator, you have to know what your community is like, particularly in the mm-hmm. public school. What kind of community are you going into? Now, if you're the administrator, the Board of Education is likely to reflect this community. So in a dominated community, you'll get a dominated board. You'll get something like the Kohler people on the board, or people in a factional community, you'll get the two sides or two or three sides mm-hmm. evenly matched, like Madison's mm-hmm. been a factional community for quite a while. And in a status congruent like Whitefish Bay, you get a lot of citizens who are very interested in the schools, and they get along very well. They don't necessarily agree on every point, but they're like you and I. We discuss things, you know, we respect each other. and we might disagree, but we're not enemies or anything. We're looking for the best solution. Mm-hmm. That's the ideal place. And then in the inert community, you're not going to get any reinforcement from the community at all. It's so what's the role of the administrator? That's the critical mm-hmm. thing. In the factional community, you have to be a political mm-hmm. strategist, because otherwise, because the board's going to change, and if you're not careful, you'll be out in your ear. In a dominated community, you better do what the dominant community wants. In critical things, they're not going to monitor everything, but you know where you're at Kohler, you do what the Kohler Corporation wants. Mm-hmm. That is, they happen to want a very good school system, so that's to your advantage. But it might not be in some other place. In a status congruent, desirable community like Whitefish Bay, you can be the professional advisor. You can play the role as it's written in the textbooks. In the inert community with nothing in the there so satisfying you, you have to play the role of decision maker. You are the decision maker. Whatever is done, you initiate. Mm-hmm. Now, what I say is that if you happen to be in a discordant set of circumstances, places that you don't fit into, you're not going to be successful. You're going to lose out. You couldn't go into a dominant community and try to run against mm-hmm. the Kohler Corporation on the critical issues. They won't tolerate that. They have the way of removing you. In a factional community, if you're not politically strategic, you'll lose out because the board changes and you'll be gone. You may be gone anyway, but at least if you're a political strategist, mm-hmm. you have a better chance. And in the community, which is like Whitefish Bay, which is a desirable community, you better be a good professional advisor. They expect it. Mm-hmm. If you don't come up with some ideas, you're going to be out because you don't meet their expectations. And in the inert community, with a sanctioning board, a board that really doesn't care too much, you know, they're just mm-hmm. sanctioning whatever you do, you'll be the decision maker. Of course, you have to be sure that you don't do something that would be mm-hmm. that would make the committee from an inert into a factional one. And I point out that these are for purposes of analysis, that communities don't fit these exactly, that they're moving,
right.
They keep moving, and it's a constant battle. And it could be that the community could change on you while you're there. That does happen mm-hmm. to people. Mm-hmm. It makes a beautiful teaching device.
Yeah.
Because people can see it right away. You know, I can say, let's take a look at Madison. What is it?
Yeah.
Factional community, they'll say. Factional board. Political strategist. Well, you see, like that, and I could point out, well, when the woman came in, the reason she failed, she was not a political strategist.
Yeah, she wasn't, yeah.
Now,
sure,
this
sure
person one is, you know.
Yeah.
He's a very good political strategist. I mean, Rainwater. I'm not saying that's not the thing to be. But he knows the dynamics. He knows what he's up against.
You have to adjust to the kind of situation. It's your job to adjust, not to dictate.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now, so he's loved right now. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got these union people with him. You know, mm-hmm. now over time, you know, that can change.
Mm-hmm.
But so far, he's doing very well because he's. Yeah. Now, what I keep saying is, you've always got to be on. You've always got to be thinking this thing through because things can change. You've got to keep your ear to the ground. See, I'm always to find out what's happening and getting feedback. I mean, don't get too comfortable, you know, that everything's fine because it's rolling right now.
The minute you do, your head will be rolling down the
right.
hill.
Because this is a, I always say, this is an uneasy profession.
Yeah.
And I believe that. I firmly believe it. I think the university, a deanship is a piece of cake compared to being a school superintendent.
And your experience has borne
yeah,
that out.
Yeah. I mean, it's a much easier job.
I could see putting this theory that you were just talking about to use in other areas, other employment situations as well. Was that ever done, do you know, applied to other?
No, it's a hard thing to do because I did it by qualitative research. You know, see, by going out and interviewing, people don't really like to work that hard. You know, a lot of researchers like to send out questionnaires or instruments or have graduate students do it. Now, you miss all the knowledge when you do that. You know, I mean, looking at transcripts is not like doing it.
It's the subtext.
Yeah,
that's
you know,
what the people
see, I interviewed
say, yeah.
The dean at Madison just the other day.
Yeah.
Now, I got much more out of that than you'll ever get from that transcript.
Yeah.
You know, because you know what it's like doing an interview. You've got me as a person. You'll never be able to recover it on the transcript. Whatever your opinion, you can only cover a certain amount of it. Isn't that true?
Well, it's one of the reasons I'm not wild about transcripts.
Sure.
I consider those secondary sources. Because listening to the tape, I think you get much closer to what that person is actually all about.
Oh, I think so, too. They'll reveal themselves.
Right.
And because they forget about the tape. I mean, the reason I don't use the tape is I don't have the facilities to do it, you know. It took me to 8 o'clock that night to get finished doing what I did.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and I was reconstructing it right after it, which I remembered almost everything I thought that he said. You know, mm-hmm. which you can, but you can't do that a day or so afterwards. You know, if you let it go 2 days, it's gone. See, so that means it's hard work, even retrieving what I was retrieving. But I couldn't afford a tape recorder. I mean, I don't have any money. That's research I'm doing now, which is often the way in education. Mm-hmm. If you want to do the kind of research that you want to do, you can't get the money for it. And that's the trick to the researcher, yeah. getting the money to do what you want to do.
Your second area was governance of colleges and universities with special roles, special reference, excuse me, to the role of academic deans.
Well, I did that because...
When
I became a dean, I thought the same, I realized it's another kind of a leadership role, mm-hmm. like the superintendent. I was on the governing board of the land grant deans. I mean, got involved. I am a politician, as you know. I mean, mm-hmm. I consider that positively. I like people anyway. Mm-hmm. So I talk a lot. I mean, I fraternize. I drink cocktails with friends, you know. I'm one of the boys, you might say. And I think that ingratiates you with people, because I'm always straight from the shoulder. I mean, I'm not one of these. And I think that means they want you on the team, so mm-hmm. to speak. So I got into the governing part of it. And we did some research, of course, on the role. Interviewing various deans and writing things up and giving reports to the body. They want to know how to be a better dean. That's what they're there for. And they want to be good and back on their own campus. And so we tend to share things. And so I wrote a book with a dean from New York University, Dan Griffiths, who was one of the outstanding deans at the time, called The Dilemma of the Deanship. Mm. And we got various people to write articles and some reporting the research we'd done. The education dean is an unreported kind of a neglected field of study. Mm-hmm. I've done some writing on it, in fact, a recent article I published not too long ago, but I like the topic, and I'm still interested in it. See, I'm still doing it. In fact, I'm doing it now. I'm trying to write another article on it, and based on Wisconsin deans, by being in the field, using that lineup that I gave you.
The technique you just...
Yeah, so, but I did publish it, and I've written articles that were published in journals. And I spent, when I was a dean, I spent a lot of time on it, you know, because it informs your own mm-hmm. work, too. Mm-hmm. I was always interested in improving my own performance, mm-hmm. becoming more knowledgeable. Well, we did extensive sampling of deans by questionnaire and that kind of reporting in the book, The Dilemma of the Deanship. I tended to work on the qualitative stuff because I like that. But the book didn't have a big sale or anything, you know, about what scholarly books do. You get the library sales the first 2 or 3 years and
that's
then
it.
You're dead, see.
You also worked on supervision of instruction and research.
I just wrote, in fact, I did one with Joanna Kaufman, an article we got in a top journal in curriculum and supervision. But I only did articles. I never wrote a book on supervision. I didn't like the textbooks, but, you know, a researcher doesn't really respect people who write textbooks, particularly. I mean, I'm talking about mm-hmm. a supervision textbook. Because you know the way you write a textbook, you get all the other textbooks around, you figure out what you're, mm-hmm. you develop your outline from that, and because if you go into too far from the unaccepted, well then the teachers at other universities won't take your textbook because they don't want to change their technique. I mean, they don't mm-hmm. want something radically different as a rule. So I never wrote a textbook, but I wrote articles on supervision. Mm-hmm. That wasn't a major thrust of mine, mm-hmm. okay. but I did some of it.
I remember interviewing a scientist once, and he said he talked about writing textbooks. He said it's in the same position, in a sense, as teaching. It's something that you just don't do. Right. And he said, how sad, in a sense, yeah. because that's what influences the students, and that's where you get your next generation of scientists and everything, from that thing that people tend to kind of overlook or poo-poo in one way or another.
I think that's the penalty of coming through a major university background. See, I went to Columbia, Chicago,
yeah,
Cornell,
right.
Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah.
And I know what academics think about.
Yeah.
I've heard people say disparaging things about textbook writers. Now, mm-hmm. I do think it's valuable. Mm-hmm. I agree with that statement, but I wouldn't want to do it myself. First of all, it takes a hell of a lot of time.
Yeah.
And you know what? And it's not new.
Yeah.
I mean, well, there's people like Kronbach who wrote an Ed Psych book, you know, that revolutionized the field.
I used that one when I was in college.
I mean, it was a great book. So yeah. He made a lot of money, too.
I'll bet he did.
Now, there is that economics book, Samuelson's Economics, mm-hmm. which made fortune, I think, for Samuelson. Yeah. And he was a Nobel Prize winner, I think. Mm-hmm. So it isn't as if nobody with competent, Kronbach was a top, you can be top and do that, but there are a lot of run-of-the-mind people who write textbooks, basically. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned Bruce Catton. Didn't you study under him? Yeah. He wrote the text, co-authored, or was one of the six authors in the American History text that I had. And it was an excellent text.
Sure.
And it did a lot to get me involved in history.
See, but Dave O'Donnell, my professor when I was at Columbia, never wrote a textbook.
Yeah.
he's more the model professor who does his research on Lincoln, you know, and stays with specialty and writes it and becomes a world famous figure in that field. And that was my model. See, mm-hmm. You have a model that you try to follow.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Last one, qualitative research, or qualitative methodology, excuse me.
I have never written much on that. I've used it more as a teaching, because that's what I taught. And I, of course, when you write up qualitative studies, you spend a lot of time on mm-hmm. the methodology.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, writing a methodological article would be, you know, to try to talk about how this particular type of qualitative methodology is better than another. Or I just never got entranced with that sort of thing. So I read all the stuff, you know, because I taught it, so I was reading all the literature, but I never wrote anything on it, except describing my own research when I would talk about the methodology of it, because I think that's very important when you're writing a qualitative study. But I've never written an article on the methodology. So I guess I would have to say it's not a research interest in a publishing sense.
What do you consider the most important research you've done?
Well, the one that I got through award is the superintendency study, because it ended in it's cited a lot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In the
citation.
That's the where you get the way you determine how good mm-hmm. you are is the number of citations mm-hmm. you get. And that was the one. I don't think the work on the deans got all that much, because as I mentioned, even a deans of letters and science, deans is a, if you look at the literature on deanship, I don't think you'll find very much any place. But certain education, you find a little less.
Well, you know, that when you started talking about it, I started flicking through my memory banks, and I don't know if I've ever seen anything on deans. I mean, I really don't think I have.
Well, you probably haven't. And I'll be able to show you an article I've got there. You know,
I'd love to see it.
But there is actually, if we get through here, but I'll show it to you.
If you could give it to me, I'll put it in your file, and the people who, or at some point, give me a copy.
I've got my one copy here. I don't have it, but I mean,
well, we can work out
that.
Yeah,
sure,
that's very interesting. Did you enjoy doing research?
Yes, I like doing research.
Oh, you like doing, I'm sorry. I keep talking about things in the past tense, and as listeners will see, Professor McCarty is still very much active in the field of education. So you enjoy doing research?
Yes, I always enjoyed it. Now, I realize it's hard work, the kind of research I do, you know, the qualitative mm-hmm. stuff where you interview people. Takes a lot of emotional effort and stick to it, mm-hmm, you know.
Mm-hmm,
and as you know from your own work, what we're talking about, you have to make appointments, you go out to see people, you have to travel sometimes to find them. You find a quiet place, you know, so that there's not interruptions, and so they'll give you the time, and then you're always feeling that, well, am I taking too much of the person's time? And then you got to go home and make something out of this, which you've got, you know, in a usable form. So you're, a lot of people don't want to do this because it's just too time-consuming. Mm-hmm. I mean, it takes a lot of energy, time, emotional commitment. You have to want to do it. You have to really be interested in the topic. And I don't think everybody can be a good qualitative researcher. I've got to impress people in a short time they want to talk to me. I've got to be charming enough or whatever it is that someone will talk about something in depth and tell me the truth and not lie to me.
You got about 30 seconds when you go in there.
Isn't that right?
Yeah.
They either make or break it right away. And you get a taciturn fellow now and then who will say yes and no, and he'll answer in cryptic one-liners. And you think, my God, I'm halfway through my interview schedule and I don't know a damn thing about this. What can I do?
Been there, done that, yeah.
Have you ever had anyone?
Yeah, sort of.
But you're not liking it too much because you're, if you're dealing
with... It's a different thing. People are volunteering and, you know, I have that passion for the university that they all share, so I don't quite have it like that. But it's always a challenge. It is always a challenge.
So it's work, you know. But you have to like it. What I mean is you've got to... And I get exhilarated after I have a good interview like I had with Chuck. I thought, my God, Chuck Reed gave me so much information. If I'm teaching leadership, I can use some of this stuff. In fact, I did. I was teaching a seminar over at Cardinal Stritch on Saturday, and they were asking me some of the leadership stuff. I mean, and I used some of Chuck Reed's stuff that he'd given me. I thought it was so good. Why not use it myself? Sure. You know what I mean? I agreed with it.
Yeah.
So what you're doing is feeding your intellect all the time.
I don't know if we explained it, but Chuck Reed is the current Dean of the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin here in Madison.
So there's advantages to it. You know? I mean, if you're doing a topic that you like, you can use it in your own work too. So it's got many paybacks, but you have to pay a price for it.
Yeah. We talked about this a little last time, but let's just go over it one more time. Could you discuss the most significant developments in the field of research that you've witnessed in Ed Edmin from the time you first entered the field back at Cornell to what's happening today?
Well, I think originally when I got into the field, the National Conference of Professors of Education Administration, most of the material at that conference had to do with skill training. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't very elevated. The textbooks were, how do you do it? How do you do plant planting, a chapter on plant planting? How do you do this? How do you do that? What wax would you use, you know, to have the floor? I mean, and then the theory movement came in around 1957, 58, 59, where all of a sudden we're going to use social science, we're going to make educational administration a theoretical sort of thing. And that had some heyday. Everybody was developing a professor of theory and organizational theory. And my own personal belief is that Edmin has never contributed anything to the theory of administration itself. I mean, it borrows from what business and sociology and psychology develop. And there is no theory of education administration, in my opinion. Now, that's a cynical view. I mean, I don't like the journal of... that we have in educational administration. I think it's pretty peripheral. And of course, what has happened now is because with postmodernism, there's been a tendency to kind of open everything up as
deconstruct,
and so now we're back to nothing again. So now I represent the jaundiced view of an old timer who's been through the wars and seen things. I believe in theory. In fact, I was explicating a theory to you about political administration that I believe in.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got evidence that it's true because I've done research with that model, and I can point out, because I used small statistical models, and we did find it out there in the real world. Now, that's not a grand theory, you see. See, the grand theory of educational administration is what social systems theory is supposed to be, you know, that you'd be able to... I don't think that's very useful, I mean, generally speaking. I subscribe to the Administrative Science Quarterly. I look at all the stuff that comes out of ASQ, which is a leading journal in leadership theory, which is used, you know, it'll be, if you get published in that, you're really a top drawer researcher. But you don't get too much out of it, you know what I mean? It isn't too much useful to the administrator. Administrators don't read these theoretical things. The actual people in the field, they go to conferences and learn from their peers about how they handle the problems, or they listen to ceremonial figures talk about grand ideas, but they don't pay attention to the technical journals because they're useless to them, you know, they can't see any connection. And I am a practitioner too, you know, and I sympathize with that point of view. When I talk to them, they understand me. See, I mean, I may use some theoretical terms, but I put it down, and I'm interested in communicating to our practitioners how we can help them, you know. And a lot of professors are never invited, you know, to practitioners. what they do to their conclaves, they bring in somebody who's got a little remedy for something, like a new disciplinary system, or, you know, which may, some of these people are carpetbaggers too, you know, they're just carrying.
So there are techniques that you're talking about.
Techniques, you know, yeah. I mean, because you like to know what the latest technique is.
Which can be helpful.
It can be helpful. All your board members are apt to ask you.
Yeah.
Why aren't we doing this? Yeah. And so you have to know, and they're not going to ask you about some arcane theory in ASQ. The only reason you would read that is if you're a graduate student getting your PhD and you figure, I've got to get some of these local, I mean, these scholarly references.
Mm-hmm. Or if you're suffering from amnesia or insomnia, perhaps.
I don't want to sound too cynical, because I read all the time. I mean, I believe that.
I understand. I was being
facetious. You know, no, you're right, though. I mean, and see, whenever one is critical like this, I'm trying to be truthful, you sound sometimes as not being elevated enough or not. Because as a leader, I would never express these kind of negative things, you know, because I think you have to be a cheerleader type, you know. And you can't go out there and denigrate what's going on. Suppose you're having a review of the North Central Association. It's better to talk to the troops about what we can get out of this and saying, well, I think it's a pain in the ass. Yeah. You know, I mean,
these theories are no good.
That's right. I mean, that doesn't help anybody. I might truthfully say to my wife or to somebody like you what I think. I'm not likely to make that straight statement public because I don't think it's useful in that setting. So there's a difference in what you believe sometimes and what you say.
What about, you said the deconstructing is starting to end in a lot of fields now. Do you have any idea where Ed Edmund is going to be going from here?
No, I don't, because I'm really not working at that level, right? I mean the theory of it, I'm really working now on the deans. But I think it'll follow the fashions, you know, what goes on in business.
Who's in, who's out?
Yeah, I mean, they'll follow the fashion. They're not, they won't be too far behind. Mm-hmm. Something will come up. I mean, these things, they have their life. And
the journals have to be fed.
They have to be fed. And you get on the ball, you know. I mean, what you do is you try to find out what's hot now so I know about it. I mean, that's why you'd have to study postmodernism. I've read a lot of that stuff, you know. You go back to the French guy, what's his name? Trying to remember it now, but and read the materials and find out if there's anything to it, because you know, you have to be aware of what's going on. If you're going to be a critic of it, I think an administrator always has to know what's going on and know the pros and the cons about it, so you know when you take a position what the other side is and how you defend yourself. When people say, I always go into battle knowing the other side as well as I can, better than they do, hopefully, so that you can't be thwarted, you know, by arguments that you don't know about or hadn't thought about. So I think postmodernism has some advantages, but I mean, I'm obviously don't buy into it.
What about professional organizations, the different, there, I think you mentioned a few of them, the National Council of Professors of Ed Edmund. Are there, there are three or four that you mentioned. Are there any that you think have particular significance or insignificance, or?
Well, when I left the deanship, I applied for and got the position of executive director of the National Conference of Professors of Educational Administration, and we housed it here at Madison. I did this because this is the one that is open up to every college, university in the country who wants to study Ed Edmund. You can send your people to this conference. It's a democratic organization. Now, the University Council of Administration is made up of 50 universities that consider themselves the best. We obviously belong with Madison, but I consider that an elitist organization. They're the ones that are more likely to talk about theory, and they think that some of these other institutions shouldn't be in business. But the other institutions are the ones who really prepare the administrators, for the most part. And some of them have very large programs. And I thought we should influence these people because they're the ones that are actually doing the work. And I tried to upgrade the programs, you know, the meetings, and make them, of course, I had to work with the board, the board of members. I mean, there was a governing board, but I was the executive. And I think during my tenure there that I did improve the National Conference of Progressive Ed, and make sure he makes it. Of course, I was also going to UCA because I represent, and people at UCA.
UCA.
University Council for Education Administration. That's the 50 outstanding.
Oh, that's the 50. Okay, gotcha.
But Harvard and Stanford don't belong. See, they were never able to get everybody into that because Harvard and Stanford don't want to pay the tuition. You have to pay $2,500 a year. You know, that's enough to keep some private university out. And some other schools don't belong. You know, they tried to get all the top, but they Teachers College Columbia doesn't belong. What I mean to say is it's an attempt to get the 50 best together, but they never get the 50. Then they bring some in that aren't quite up to tough either, you know, but they do it for prestige reasons, marginal kinds of institutions. So you never get what you're looking for anyway. But a lot of people see if we belong to UCA, this is you know, the fact that we're a better preparing institution. I don't believe that at all in my estimation. And so I think that gives you where I come from. Mm-hmm. That is, I like to try to get to the grassroots and influence the programs that are going to do this thing. Mm-hmm. Anyway, why not give them the opportunity? Now, they can go to UCA, meaning if they pay a certain extra admission fees, but most don't because they don't feel it's an appropriate place for them. So I always went to UCA meetings, but I didn't feel that they were reaching out enough, you know, that they were too confined to their own elitism.
Mm-hmm. We're ending. You were also very involved in numerous research accreditation and consulting teams to local school districts, to state DPIs, to all different kinds of things. Could you talk about the nature of your involvement in these different organizations, and also give perhaps a few examples of the kinds of specifically the kinds of things you did?
When I was a graduate student at Chicago, the North Central Association was stationed there. The executive director was a professor of higher ed at University of Chicago. When I came up to deanship in Wisconsin, he invited me to become an examiner for the North Central Association, and I went down there and went through their training session. So early in my career here, I became a North Central evaluator. What that means is when the North Central Association every 10 years or so credits each institution in the North Central, you have to have that to get federal grants, so it's an absolute requirement. And I worked on teams all over the North Central region, which is a big region from Arizona, you know, to West Virginia.
Oh, really? I didn't realize it was.
It's the biggest region. It covers a tremendous amount of territory. And over the years, I became pretty good at it, I think, so they made me chairman. Towards the end, I was chairman on all these teams. And I did a lot of it, and they would call me in. I also served on review committees of North Central reports. You know, the report would be made, and if the institution doesn't like it, they can come to the North Central meeting and protest and say, we think this is unfair, we don't like your recommendation, because if you think an institution needs something wrong, you might say they'll give this 6 years, which means before the next visit, which is in a sense saying you're not up to snuff here, or they may ask you to write reports. In other words, an institution doesn't want to do that, and so they come and protest the recommendation. If you're the chairman of the team, you have to argue for the report, of course, as against the institution. You become their enemy then, basically. Now, I served on these review teams, you know, I mean, the review committees, so I got real insights into the total operation, and the people at North Central became my friends. I worked with them so much. So I learned an awful lot because they sent me all over the North Central region, and you learn a lot, which helps you in your own business.
I'll bet.
Helps you teaching and helps you administering because you have a bigger perspective. Mm-hmm. And it was fun. We got paid $150 a day, and if you were the chairman, you got an extra $150. Of course, not much money for all the tournaments you're going through. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a money-making venture, but it was useful, I think, for a person like myself, and I enjoyed it.
Yeah, you must have learned just a tremendous amount of not only what not to do, but what to do, but what not to do.
That's correct. I learned, and I kept doing that even after I left the deanship, of course, because they, by that time, I was one of their regulars, so to speak. I think they thought I knew what I was doing, because I always went to the, I even taught at some of the training sessions for other people. And so I kept up to date, because they're always changing their procedures. And I did some NK work too, because this National Council for Accreditation of Teacher Ed, because I thought we should get back into that as a means of leveraging the faculty to look at themselves. And I noticed that Dean Reed said, well, the hardest thing is that we brought in some people to look at one of our departments, and then 10 internal institutional review. And what they did is they sent me a letter after it was all over in elegant language, saying they weren't going to change anything that they were now doing. See, this is the problem you have with this concept. You know, you don't have leverage. Well, an outside agency can give you a little leverage, at least the people have to respond to whatever the criticisms are. So I did Ohio State University, I did University of Texas as chairman, and then brought in the NK team here, and we came through in flashing colors. And so all the time I was dean, I worked for NK, you know, as a member of teams. And we were NK approved when I was the dean.
With either NCAID or North Central, did you ever, as either chairman or a member of the committee, was there ever a time where you thought you might have to, you know, threaten to take away accreditation?
Well, I've been on teams where we put them on probation, which is, you know, Milton College was eventually disaccredited by North Central before they collapsed. But see, that's usually the last gasp.
That's the last step. Yeah.
Probation is very serious. Yeah. Now, we did that one time to an institution in North Dakota that I was on, and I saw the fellow at a national meeting, and he looked at me with daggers like he'd like to kill me if he could. Mm. You know, I mean, I can understand, because it's his life and blood. You know, it's a state university, but they weren't supporting him. It was on the western part of North Dakota in a dismal little location, and, you know, it was a marginal institution. You know how those places are. And I felt sorry for him.
What do you generally say about them that's so negative? And what are you looking at might cause
finance, of course. You see, like Milton College, you look for finance first of all. You need a very strong person working your financial aspect, because what can you do in 2 or 3 days?
Right.
Well, you can get the finances straight. I mean, you can find out if they're a private school, are they making money, so to speak? They're running deficits, so they have a big deficit they're trying to carry. What's the nature of the salary schedules? You know, a lot of things. Also, there's an open session where faculty members can come in and complain if they want to. And sometimes in smaller institutions, things will come up. I went to Illinois State one time, and they had a regular revolution going on there against the president. You know, people were so discontented. And so you pick all of this kind of stuff up. If there's anything desperate going on, you probably will pick it up.
You'll get that, yeah.
Now, a place like UW-Madison would be extremely difficult, you know, to pick up. You might pick up, as has been done in the past, too much autonomy. But, you know, that's not hard for, I remember Irv Shane responding to that one time. You know, I mean, you know, if you're at Madison, you respond to that too much autonomy is, with elegant language, indicating the beauty of it, not the limitations of it. So it doesn't. We don't feel hurt if they say we have too much autonomy. But I think you can do some very useful work, because North Central's really approach is to improve the institution. They're not there to discredit them.
Yeah.
So what they do is point up the areas you have to improve, and they have certain remedies like writing reports, a two-person visit in a certain period of time, you know, you have varying degrees, final revisit in 6 years. And so what you do is act as a consultant. I always considered my role, you know, as a consultant. And when I didn't ever discredit anybody, but I gave some hard reports, you know, but it was designed to be positive, you know, critical, but things they had to, well, that could help the institution itself with its own board of trustees. Look, the North Central Association, you gotta have North Central approval, right? So if I say something to Edgewood College, they better correct it, you know. But if you're a member of a team, you don't want to make it miserable for these people. I mean, if they're trying, you feel that there's something there, you try to help them. That's your role, basically. So it can be a satisfying role, you know, that you're helping the institution. But you have a team, of course. You don't know what that team is going to do. I mean, you and I are on the same team, another person. Sometimes people are super critical when they go out visiting, and then you have to tame people down. I mean, they want to garrote them. I mean, so the purpose, I knew that North Central knew that I was a reasonable person.
Yeah.
And they have to trust their chairman, yeah, you know, to make sense out of all this and play the game, too. They don't want to get in a running fight with some institution.
Yeah.
But they want to help it. I mean, they're basic. Really, they are trying to help institutions, to be perfectly honest with you.
You don't come in with two swords, with your swords flashing. You just want to come in there and...
Well, you come in very nicely, yeah, you know, and you try to be as friendly as possible. You meet with the president. That's the key thing, to see what the president says. If the president is smart, they'll identify some of the areas of weakness where they really want you to comment. If the president gives you a song and dance, you know, you don't have much respect for him because you know you're going to find out. They can't really hide the real thing, dangerous things. And some presidents are very forthcoming, others, you know, mm-hmm, kind of play the entertainment thing. They think if they meet you at the airport and have a nice dinner, you know, so that you're going to be nice to them, you know. So it's a game where you have to have political skills as a North Central evaluator, because you're working for the North Central, you're working for the institution in a sense, you're working for yourself and your colleagues. You want a report that will stand up under scrutiny. You want your colleagues to think you've done a good job, that you're not soft-peddling them. You know, I mean,
yeah,
you've got
it's
a variety.
A lot of responsibility.
A lot of varieties.
It's
a major task.
It's very interesting. You have 3 days to do this.
And you work hard.
Yeah, I'll bet you do.
But it's qualitative research, really, because mm-hmm, you're interviewing people in a short time. The same sort of things we're
and
talking
about. And it's politics, so it's just your cup of tea.
That's right. I enjoy it.
I can see why you're good at it. You mentioned also one thing that I just want to talk about for a moment. You talk about you work with state DPIs. Mm-hmm. What do you do with them?
Well, what I was involved with there is, you know, like the state of Maryland, for instance, might want to have someone look at, they have, of course, the county systems, you know, they would have maybe 13 or 14 counties in the state of Maryland, and they would bring you as a consultant to look at their operation, and they would do a self-study. They're really hiring you as an outside expert to come in, that kind of consulting, mm-hmm, and I've done that in New York State and in Massachusetts and Louisiana, where you're out visiting various institutions. You report to the Board of Higher Education or to some agency that hired you about your findings, and usually you have a team, you know, mm-hmm, two or three other people. And that's a lot of fun. And you get it because of your reputation, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, as a...
That's interesting.
And when you're in a job like a dean at Madison, you get a lot of offers to do a lot of different things. And the question is, what do you accept and what don't you accept? I don't accept things like Platteville calls me up, would you give the commencement address to Platteville for $200? No thanks, you see. Too much work.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can fail miserably to get up there. I mean, if you give a commencement speech, which you're not giving regularly, think of the work involved.
Yeah.
I turn down lots of things that I would have enjoyed doing if I had all the time in the world, but you can't do it, see.
Mm-hmm.
But these things that I did, I always learned something, mm-hmm, from. It wasn't that I was getting a munificent income from it, but I was getting insights that you could use. And, well, for instance, I know a lot about these various states that you wouldn't know otherwise.
Oh, as a professor of Ed Edmund, yeah, yeah, you're just getting constant.
And, you know, we are,
input,
in a sense, we are a state, education is a, yeah, state function, so, and it's a lot of decentralized. The federal government doesn't do a lot, you know, basically, with education.
When and why did you decide to retire?
Well, I had, you mean from the...
From UW-Madison.
From the university?
From the university, yes.
Because of age, basically. You don't have to retire anymore, but at the time I was retiring, Ross Miller and Spruther were retiring, and it seemed a good time, you know, for three of us to go together. And I wanted to stay more than they did, same. But I felt maybe that they want me to leave. You know, you don't, I'm talking about the deans.
Mm.
Why? I mean, because this opens up positions.
Mm-hmm.
You have to bring in new blood, you know, if you suppose you, mm-hmm, are minorities or women. So I left because I thought it was the appropriate thing to do, not because I wanted to. And in fact, the first year after I retired, I went to work every day, just like I always did, because I could handle graduate students. I still had plenty
to handle. And I worked like I was, even though I was not being paid, I mean, I was being paid my retirement, which is very good, incidentally.
Getting better.
I expect to get a raise May 1st.
Yes, you will.
And it'll be better than last year. See, so I have no complaints about that retirement. But I'm not retired, really, you know. I'm working over.
Well, that's my next thing. We've talked off mic a lot about this, and it doesn't seem like you've slowed down much at all. Could you talk about how you got involved in your post-retirement career, I guess we can call it?
Well, what happens is Cardinals Trich called me up, and they had developed a new EDD program, a Doctor of Education degree program.
This was about, when did they call you up, excuse me?
2 or 3 years ago.
Okay.
And I've completed my second year there. Mm-hmm. And they had been turned down for North Central. Hmm. Of course, I knew a lot about North Central. And they asked me what I knew, and I sent them the list of 50 schools that I'd served on as chairman or a member.
50?
It was that many.
Wow. That's impressive.
Probably one of the leading...
That is impressive.
...record. But see, I went for a long time. And that impressed them, all right. So they called me in for an interview. And I liked the people right away. They were very decent people. They are a nice group of people. So, and I fit in that I'm a Catholic, and I'm an Irish Catholic. So I can talk about Franciscan values as well as Dominican values. So it was a place where I would be, you know, at home. And so I agreed to serve for $20,000 a year, half-time. Nothing magnificent. And when you drive back and forth and all that, sometimes I stay over. I mean, I'm not getting rich.
Right.
So it wasn't money. I did it because I wanted to keep active. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was a legitimate program that I had. It was for mid-career people. And the delivery system is on weekends once a month, Friday night, Saturday all day, and Sunday afternoon. And a 2-week summer school, 3 years is the idea. Program is designed to have the dissertation done at the end of 3 years. I've got a couple of dissertation proposals over there now I'm working on. So, and I'm meeting a student tomorrow at 8:15 on my way to Milwaukee. So I was able to help them get credit. When they came back the second time, I was there, see, and I know the North Central thing, cold turkey, so I know what to say, and I talked to these people about how to present themselves. I had my vita out there, and I'd stress this is an EDD, you know, this is not a PhD, you know. We're developing a degree, which is, we have a body of people that want this, that will not go to UW-Milwaukee. We're not, I mean, this is not a competitive enterprise. It's true, it isn't. And these people want the degree not because they're going on to get more jobs. They've already got a decent job at this time. They just want to sort of cap off their career and have the doctorate. They let us through with flying colors.
Hmm.
Ten year approval.
What had been the problem before?
Well, they had bad luck. See, the chairman of the visiting team was a professor from Northwestern, and he thought a place like Cardinals Trich should never offer a doctor's degree. Hmm. He was an elitist.
Mm-hmm.
And now, if you're dealing with a person who came next time was not an elitist. But the chairman. In fact, I knew him very well. He's a professor of admin, actually. I knew him extremely well. A very likable guy, but he didn't think that, and he excoriated him for trying to do this. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was nasty to him. So that's why they lost the first time. And you can see that if you get, even I have some reservations. Edgewood is thinking about having an EDD program. Mm-hmm. I mean, might have reservations about Edgewood. It would depend on who they had. Now, of course, they had some good people at Cardinals Trich. They really do have some good people. Now, they're not researchers, but they're excellent teachers. They're bright. They've done administration themselves. They're knowledgeable practitioners. So that's their strength. I mean, they know what they're talking about. They read. They go to conventions. I mean, they're on the ball. They're very able people. So, we got approved, and what they don't understand is we've now got 3 cohorts, and we're going to have another one this summer. Then we'll have 4. We take 28 in a cohort. They're going to have so many doctoral students, they're not going to know what the hell they're going to do. See, now, I've already indicate we're only going to have 3 members on the committee, and you know, I come here and manage to get end up with 5. And I'm trying to use people from the outside, people with PhDs, you know, that are practitioners. So I'm trying to help them run this program. I want to stay with it until we get some graduates. I hope I can do that. I got a contract for next year. I'm up at $22,000 now. I want you to know.
Going through the ceiling here.
But it's fun because they treat me like I'm about 50 years old over there. How are you, Don? You know, and you want a cup of coffee? You know, would you like a cookie? Oh, that's a nice tie. That's a power tie you got on today, you know. And they embrace me, you know, because I fit into their framework. Because they know what I really believe in what they're doing. And I do, you know, I think they're good people. So it's fun, and my wife is glad to have me do it, because she says you'll come back so energized, you're so happy, that you probably wouldn't be if you were here all the time reading the New York Times and all these books that I can't read now because I don't have time. I got them all stacked right there. But it's fun, and that's why I'm still doing research.
Yeah.
I figure you got to model what you're supposed to do. So when NCATE came in, we were reviewed by NCATE. I had my vita down, all the things I'd done over research, Nature, what I was doing, what I published recently, because I had published some stuff. And so now I'm performing just like a regular professor, because I have a purpose for it. And this article will be published, that I'm working on, I know will be published. But at some place, because you learn in the business, if you try the best journals, you think it might accept it. They don't take it. Take it somebody else. You'll eventually get it published. Persistence is the business. Mm-hmm. You keep going, and I learned that over the years. Maybe you make a revision now and then. But it's fun still working at 78 years of age.
And Cardinal Street sounds like a real nice match for you.
Well, it's a beautiful place, you know. It's up there in Whitefish Bay. It's right by the lake. It's a magnificent... It's easy to get to from downtown. Mm-hmm. I mean, 10 minutes, you know, you can be from downtown Milwaukee to Cardinal Stritch, and you got all kinds of parking space. It's like a elite campus. I mean, basically, I mean, you're away from all the mess of downtown Milwaukee, so that they have a good situation. Now, their undergraduate college, of course, isn't very large. They have the old marginal problems. They don't have any debt, though, incidentally. Mm. There's no debt. And maybe that's because they haven't been entrepreneurish enough in many ways. Their main fault is not the School of Education, it's the superstructure that operates, like the admissions office in some of those places. If I were managing the place, I'd really tighten that up, because I think they ought to be terribly user-friendly. And they're not so much. It's because they haven't hired the right people, paid the right salaries, and so some of their bookstores don't operate the way they should, and that sort of thing. And that a good administrator would get right in there and straighten that out. Yeah. See, they don't have anybody to do
that. Now, those small colleges don't have much margin for error these days.
No, they don't.
They really don't.
You got to have the tin cup if you're the president. Because you can't get by with tuition, say, so you're... I wouldn't want to be a president of a small college for that reason.
That must be terrible.
It is terrible, I think. If you're Swarthmore or something, that's different.
Yeah, but you're... Yeah, Cardinal Stritch, you're just out there hustling.
Or Edgewood.
Yeah, Edgewood.
Yeah, all the... See, that's what happened to Milton College. I mean, they just couldn't manage. Couldn't get enough income.
At the end of an interview, I have every interview I do, I have something called the last word, and that's your chance to say give any closing comments you might have about your career at the university.
Well, I must say I enjoyed talking to you about this. I mean, I loved the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I had a good time, you know. I enjoyed my service as dean. I wish that I knew as much as I know now when I was dean. I would have been a better one, more of a risk taker, more confident, all the things I think you'll get as you get more experienced and reflect. Even the professors that used to frighten me, because I thought they were brighter, more prestigious than I wouldn't frighten me now, because my role is to be the leader, is not to, I'm not putting, I used to put myself up against them from a scholarly standpoint, which is a foolish way to look at it. I mean, I should have said, well, what I'm doing is a certain part of the equation, and what you're doing is another part of the equation. We don't have to be judged on the same criteria. You don't know anything about administration, maybe. That's my field of specialization. And maybe I had four children when I went through, which meant it was hard for us to entertain. I would have liked to have done more of that, because I think that's always good, you know. I just couldn't expect my wife to do everything under the sun. We didn't have any money in those days to support that sort of thing. From now, I did one good thing when I was dean. I started the account over in the foundation, UW Foundation. I gave a lecture over in Spain and made $2,500, and I deposited that in that account. And then what happened is that when graduates of the School of Education turned in their money to UW Foundation, they identified the School of Ed, because that was one mm-hmm. of the names. And all of a sudden, money started rolling in. You know, now they get over $1 million a year in money into the foundation. And you know what that does for you as a dean of a school of education? You can entertain properly, for one thing. Not that you waste money, but and you can take certain ventures that you can't do because the state doesn't have it. You have a little leverage. You have a fund that gives you the chance to make moves that you can't make otherwise. Now that was part of it, just accident, you know. And I never thought it was gonna. I didn't do it with design that it would, but it was a move that worked out beautifully, and it became a real bonanza. So sometimes you realize that on your watch, that there's a lot of luck involved mm-hmm. in this, and I think that helps you when you're reflecting back. That. I had good luck when I was dean. I mean, I never had any real tragedies. I had some mistakes, but they weren't serious. And so most of my things were positive, and I enjoy it. And the longer you stay away from it, even your enemies have forgotten about you. You know what I mean? And now you get embraced by just about everyone. You know what I mean? That's the beauty of being out a long time. I'm still alive, and people, like Wednesday, we're having a big party for 3 retirees, and I'm going there, and everybody will be clapping me on the back and saying, "How are you, Don?" You know, they've forgotten everything they remember of a negative nature. That's the truth. I mean, you become kind of canonized. It's almost like seeing what your funeral's going to be like. I know if I were to die tomorrow, there'd be a lot of people at the funeral. Of course, if I get too old, if I'm up in the 90s, there won't be anybody there. No, I really enjoyed it, and I just wish I could do it again with the knowledge that I have now. Not for a longer period of time, but a little more productive, you know, maybe, than I was.
Well, I'd like to say that I enjoyed this interview very much as well, and thank you very much for your time and for your insights.
It was fun.
The end of this interview.